The Denisons, the Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Yes, Dr. Drew, this is Denisons, and we're coming to you from Montana. And drove up here last week. We drove instead of flying because did not want them to wear the mask for however many hours that was. But it was great. The kids got their first real cross-country road trip.
Oh, that's cool.
It was really typical. And that's the voice of Dr. Drew Pinsky here on the Denisons today. Here to talk about life, what's going on, and what we hope goes on in the future.
I wish I had better sense of that, man. I'll tell you what. I'm personally depressed by that very issue, by being unable to sort of plan ahead. I my whole life has been about what's going to happen in 6 months and how am I going to do this and having hope and enthusiasm for the future. And I can't even, I don't know what to think about the future. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we're talking about the future and how tough it is to plan. And it's kind of crazy. So Dr. Drew, are you in Pasadena right now?
I am in Pasadena right now and sort of hold up. I've been spending way too much time in this house. The nice thing has been, you know, we have triplets. I know you have twins.
Yeah.
Our kids are 27 now. And my daughter lives in Brooklyn, but the boys have moved home in the face of all this. And it's been nice. It's been nice having them back in, even though I feel like I don't want to handicap them. I want them to go, but there's nowhere to go. They too have had their lives sort of closed down by the current situation.
Yeah, my kids the same. You know, first it was Zoom school, and then their camp in Texas was canceled a week before they went. And that was another reason for putting him in the car and coming up here to Montana to give him some sort of a summer vacation. And this is just, it's kid heaven up here, kid heaven, dog heaven, everything you could possibly think of. It's fantastic.
It's weird how there's untoward or at least unforeseen aspects of this whole thing. I'm sure when we look back on this, there'll be trajectories that were established during all this, some good, some bad. But getting your kids into Montana seems like the good side of it. But you know, I worry about how old are your kids?
They're 12.
Yeah, I believe 8 to 15-year-olds are going to be profoundly impacted by this time. I mean, think about your own development, how that period, you're just a sponge to the world. And imagine you're growing up in a time when you can't see your peers, everything is shut down, you can't go to school, your parents seem upset and anxious, and you believe, you hear on every time you turn on the television, that outside is this thing that's going to get you. And it's got to have an impact on their development. And we have to be really cautious about that.
You know, we have been. And at the same time, they've been going to, they went to surf camp. Well, I wouldn't call it camp. It's surf lessons down at Manhattan Beach. And because they said, you know, the beaches were fine. The heat was fine. It's not going to be there. And then they changed their mind again about that. And it seems like every time we make a plan, somebody in charge changes their mind based on numbers and projections that nobody knows, because it's the first time anybody in the world has ever documented this like this. We don't know what the trajectories are, what the rates of infection are. It's just a big guess. We don't even know if it's a natural thing or invented in a lab. So we just don't know.
That's absolutely correct. And every time you hear politicians say, we're just following the science, that is a load of BS. They're looking at models, not science. They're looking at models. And think about models. Models try to predict the weather. They try to predict the markets. And they're trying to predict the behavior of virus. They're not science. They're just statistical models to try to help us understand where we are. No one can predict the future with these things. The actions they take are capricious and arbitrary. Please, somebody, show me a scientific study that shows you that somebody has caught this virus in a nail salon. Why did you close down nail salons after requiring them to entirely change their business to make them safer? Good. And then you close them down. In fact, hair salons, same thing. In fact, in Missouri 2 days ago, two women with COVID cut hairs for a week. They didn't know they had it. They found out at the end of the week. In that week, they exposed themselves to 139 people with proper mask technique and hand washing and all that stuff. And the transmission rate was zero. And so you close them down too. That's science? No, that's arbitrary.
You go into a convenience store, or they shut down churches, but they have liquor stores open. I don't understand it. You know, we're not going back to school.
By the way, a lot of rhetoric about the First Amendment, which I think is great.
Yes.
Protect people's First Amendment right to protest, but don't pretend that that isn't a region for transmission. Of course,
okay.
If transmission doesn't occur that way, there shouldn't have been a shutdown in the first place.
Yes.
And secondly, but if you're going to protect it, and if you're going to protect the First Amendment for demonstration, which I support, you have to protect it for church services too. Then you can't pick which part of the First Amendment you want. So this is the kind of garbage we're dealing with now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I do think that the protest did have something to do with the pandemic making a surge.
If it didn't, please don't talk to me ever again about shutdowns, because then you're talking total nonsense. Now the good news is, yes, it caused some transmission. Of course it did. Of course it did. And yes, maybe the shutdown early served a purpose while we figured out what was going on, you know. But don't pretend. We've got to pretend things. And by the way, Dennis, when it comes to public health messaging, the public, you lose the public if you exaggerate, if you're hypocritical, if you're inconsistent. I've been doing public health messaging my whole career, and I've watched the excesses result in the inability to change the behavior of particularly young people. For instance, the overstatement of the risk of cannabis, or we were very aggressive in our messaging around HIV and AIDS. Well, now I can't get anybody to wear a condom. And so you got to be consistent. You can't be hypocritical, and you've got to be clear, or you lose people. And that's where people are now just... they don't want to hear it anymore.
I quite agree with you about that. You know, to put this into some context too, you came out recently and apologized for what you called a misstatement, or you were wrong, you said, about what you thought early on. And I thought that was actually very courageous of you to do. And it shows a lot of wisdom, to tell you the truth, because that's how we get wisdom, is by our mistakes and self-examination. But at the beginning, Nobody really knew. Everybody's taking their best guess. The president shut down travel to China, and people called him xenophobic. And now everybody's, saying you've got to wear a mask. And it's on both sides, too, I must admit, because, this is not a political thing. It's a pandemic, for God's sakes. We got to take care of each other and not politicize it. And I'm sick and tired of the politicizing of it.
Oh, my God, you can't imagine how I feel about it as a physician. But I'm super moderate. I see both sides, and I see the excesses on both sides. And so I'm not a party person. I'm not a partisan person. And one of the reasons I was so aggressive in my rhetoric in the beginning is I could see what was coming. I could see that the press was going to usurp medicine, that doctors were not going to be in charge of what we are normally in charge of, which is the care of the public health system and the rendering of services to people who fall victim to the pandemic. I could see that the panic that the press was in was going to start to create untoward consequences. And then, so here it came. And lo and behold, then you have the New York Times Board of Editorial demanding lockdown. New York Times editorial writers have no business discussing anything in medicine. They should be reporting it and not dictating medical care. And now it's almost impossible for physicians to understand what's going on or to get control of this thing. Imagine, I've done a little thought experiment. What if we had, this was what I was trying to get across to people, is that we had a pandemic in 2009. The H1N1 epidemic that killed 600,000 people. It infected somewhere between a half a billion and a billion people. I had it. It was horrible.
Were there like something like 28,000 cases in the United States before anything was done about it?
Oh yeah. Oh no. It was. But the point is, we dealt with it. It was a nasty outbreak. It wasn't as contagious as this one. It was different. I mean, it's not. But one of the mistakes that I was apologizing for was comparing epidemics to sort of a false, it's sort of a faulty, logic. But it is worth now looking back and going, you know, in 2009, it was like the third story on the news. Doctors are taking care of it. It's awful. The public health officials are on it. Stay tuned. Watch Dr. Fauci. He'll tell you what to do. And on to the other stories. And you barely knew it happened. And it killed 600,000 people.
Right.
Now we're in a complete and total spin panic about this one. And I'm not saying we shouldn't deal with this one more seriously. I'm saying that the divide between you barely knew it happened and total panic seems excessive to me.
Yeah, both of these came came from China, originated in China. Did they not? Yeah, swine flu was documented as being a natural occurring phenomenon, whereas COVID, we don't exactly know yet.
Correct.
Yes.
There are aspects of the biology, or really the genetics of this virus that make it hyperinfectious, that are sort of characteristic of changes that people use in biowarfare. Not to say that it couldn't occur in nature, it just tends not to. And so that's what has people kind of look.
That particular bat that it came from didn't live within 500 miles of that lab or the city of Wuhan.
Right. Those sorts of question marks. Again, no one is saying there's no smoking gun, but there are question marks. Mm-hmm. Going, I don't know.
Were the Chinese more forthcoming with the swine flu?
It's a great question. I don't remember how it, because you didn't really see it unfold because it wasn't in the press. I just remember when it was here and dealing with it as a clinician and then dealing with it as a patient.
I do remember it being reported and it being starting to get a little bit scary. And then it just seemed to fade. But you yourself had it, you said.
And it killed 20 to 40-year-olds, unlike this one, which killed, you know, 80-year-old plus. That one killed.
Right.
You know, another thing, I don't know if you feel this way, Dennis, but I think, you know, the fact that this is affecting old people, or that, let's put it this way, old people are at the center of the focus of so much of this conversation around coronavirus.
Yeah.
To me, it should motivate us to have conversations with our loved ones, with ourselves, about what our end of life issues are, how we feel about nursing homes, yes or no. I mean, because I worked in nursing homes for years and years and years, and I'm very clear. If I deteriorate neurologically or physically to the point that I need institutional care, please get a palliative care specialist, call hospice, let me go. I want none of this. The average life expectancy in a nursing home is somewhere between 6 months and 22 months. And they're not pleasant months, trust me.
No, it's I've been there many times. My mother was in a retirement home, and I was just barely, she passed last year at 91, and this would be really tough if she was around today. I have to admit it. I get a little emotional about it, but to the worry that I would have about her. She lived a great life. It's 80, I understand, is about the average age of people who are dying from the pandemic, is correct?
So have real conversations with people who are your loved ones in the 80s. Do they want a ventilator? Do they want ICUs? Those things, if they deteriorate to the point where they're in that condition, the probability of survival is relatively low. The probability of a horrible year following that is high. And the probability of living beyond a year is almost zero.
Well, it'd be a lot better to... Yeah, it'd be a lot better to have that in a personal and a family decision than have that be sort of a government decision, which are basically death boards, right?
Well, absolutely. Or you write this stuff down ahead of time. And by the way, the kinds of conversations I'm hearing now are kind of interesting, where people like a man age 75 is going, hey, you're asking me to cash in a year of my life. I'm statistically not going to live much past 80. That's 20% of my remaining time. You want me to cash that down to save maybe five more years and maybe the virus is going to kill me? I want that year back. I'm not going to give you that year. I mean, those are the kinds of conversations you'll have with older people now, which is like, don't rip, I might take my year away from me. I don't have many years left.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you what you think about schools reopening? Do you have an opinion, or do you have enough information or yourself to have an opinion about it?
I'm confused. I got to say, I the American Academy of Pediatrics, I looked at two, when it comes to school open, I looked at two sources. Anthony Fauci is somebody that I have been around for my entire career. He's actually the reason I got involved in the radio in 1983. Mm. It was him telling young physicians to go out and educate about HIV and AIDS. So I looked to Fauci. He's been spot on his entire career. So I'm waiting for him to really ring in on this issue. I also would look to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics has come down strongly in favor of opening schools, mostly because they're concerned about the risk-reward of staying closed. In other words, they're saying, well, some kids are going to get sick, but a lot of kids are going to have social-emotional problems if we don't do this. So yes. Let's see if they all align, whether Fauci and they align. And I think the American Academy of Pediatrics has backed off a little bit. So, again, I'm a little confused.
The school is a place where kids learn to socialize, learn to get along with one another, and where they compete. Just getting out and having vitamin D. And there's so many skills that you can't really get on a Zoom. It's structure. It's structure of society.
You know, and we're already losing sports, right? Nobody's talking about bringing sports back, which is a major loss for a lot of kids. 25% of the mental health conditions amongst young people get picked up at school. Kids that are in more problematic family circumstances, it's the schools that detect this and intervene. And all that's going to, that's just sort of, you know, just on right now. It's just whatever's happening in these environments where kids are getting abused, it's just happening. It's just rolling forward and no one's able to do anything. This is my general note is, we have politicians making clinical decisions. They're not used to the untoward effects of medical decision making. But every time we're used to it as doctors, we know every decision we make, including come into my office, has potential for harm to you. Our system is fraught with difficulties. I know you've been exposed to some of it personally. We take choices over here. It has effects somewhere else, but we anticipate it. We're constantly looking for that. Politicians or leaders are not used to.
And these medical decisions are being used to bludgeon the other side through politics. If you look at the figures too, going today, how many cases have been in the United States? It's getting up there. And how many people, the number of people have died is, I think it's crested over 200,000 at this time. Every year in this country, there are 200,000 deaths from medical errors in hospitals. That are, you're talking about needless, yet we're screaming about this when there's always been something in front of us. But this can be politicized so much easier, and those are silent and one at a time.
We're not just screaming; we're apoplectic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Screaming is appropriate. This is a dangerous thing. We got to be on it. I don't doubt. I'm not diminishing the importance of paying attention here, but the apoplexy we've fallen into is what I'm concerned about.
And also, what about the homeless? I know that you've really worked with the homeless. It is a passion of yours. And I myself have done that. I've been out to 5th and Main in Los Angeles. You go down there and take a look, and everything is piling up now. There's so many homeless that it's exploded. Really started to become a real problem, I would say, back in the 80s. They cut back on mental illness funding for institutions, I believe, and it just let people out on the street. And I do agree with you that one of the biggest issues is mental illness with homeless people that just doesn't get addressed.
Right. I wish we would get rid of the term homeless, because if somebody's homeless, it suggests that if you give them a home, you've solved the problem.
Right.
Well, nothing could be further from the truth when it comes to the population on the street. I actually give a lecture on this, on how this happened. It essentially goes back to the 1950s and 1960s when some eager beaver psychiatrists set up the National Institute of Mental Health. They convinced President Kennedy to sign the Community Mental Health Act. The Community Mental Health Act was designed to choke off the funding to state mental hospitals, a system that took 150 years to put in place. Some were good, some were awful.
Yeah, but they were, the public thought that they were terrible. Yes,
correct.
Sorry.
And they were choked off in favor of community mental health centers whose sole goal, those community mental health centers, was to, quote, prevent mental illness, something we don't know how to do to this day. They made no provisions for what was going to happen for the care and follow-up on the hundreds of thousands of people pouring out of these state hospitals. So they emptied onto the streets, the nursing homes, and the prisons. And since then, we've just continued to make more and more egregious legal decisions, legislation, that makes it more and more impossible to render care to these people. And they're dying, like, at an extraordinary rate. And in my humble opinion, it's murder. And particularly in California, the laws are extra ridiculous. And they're killing my patients. They're killing my patients and preventing us from helping them.
There's other people on the street who are preying off of these people with drugs, with sex trafficking. It's just got to be horrible. Ed, what do you know about how the homeless, how they are doing?
They're doing horribly. Like, I mean, it's an open air asylum. Oh, well, they've actually had a surprisingly low incidence of COVID. They have had a high incidence of asymptomatic infection. And the irony is most of the symptomatic infection occurred in people who were brought inside. So if you go into a shelter, you're a little higher incidence of symptomatic COVID. But generally, they've done remarkably well. So for some reason, whether it's the UV light or being out of doors or the lack of proximity, because they are pretty spread out, they are doing pretty well with the COVID. Now, will they continue to do well remains to be seen.
Yeah. What about doctors and healthcare workers? There's this, maybe it's one of those myths that we hear, but sort of the idea is that doctors are around sick people so much that they build up immunity to certain diseases because they just take it on. But COVID is supposedly different. I mean, I don't get that one either. But
COVID is transmitted like a common cold. It's respiratory tract to respiratory tract, right? So if you cover your respiratory tracts and use careful technique, you're not going to transmit. It's not like influenza that transmit multiple ways. And by the way, influenza primarily transmits through children to adults. COVID almost never does that. It's just a different kind of a thing, and you can't possible to protect yourself. There's a weird thing going on now. I'll tell you what, Dennis. There's a guy named Vladimir Zelenko, who I interviewed the other day, who is so convinced that the combination of hydroxychloroquine and zinc is an effective, not just treatment, but also prophylactic agent. He has stopped wearing protective gear. He takes care of thousands of COVID patients, and he is exposing himself actively to the virus to make the point that this combination is effective as a prophylactic agent. So there's an experiment going on here. We'll see if he gets it.
It's going to be interesting. The virus is not mutated at this point. They're looking for a vaccine for it, which they're working on. It usually, typically, even the best case scenario, it's 18 months, I believe, to get a vaccine going or find one if they can. So that puts us about a year out from that. What about a round two? If there is another season of this thing, this is a question I think on a lot of people's minds. Will it mutate? Will it be a different virus that needs like a different vaccine, just like every year we get a different vaccine for that particular strain of flu?
Right. So you're asking really four really complicated questions. So let me try to back my way into them. The mutations do occur. There has been some mutation already that has conferred upon the virus greater infectivity, greater ability to be contagious, yet they've not seen that actually clinically manifest. So they're seeing some mutations that should make it more infectious, but it's not becoming more infectious. So that's interesting. But because they are directing the vaccine primarily at the spike proteins on the coronavirus, those are very stable. Those don't change over time. And so the coronavirus, unlike influenza, does not change enough to need multiple vaccines or yearly vaccines. So that's the second question. So we may need to take a vaccine every year to boost up our immunity, but we're probably not going to need different vaccines every time. So that's a thing. Now, you mentioned the different vaccines. There are, like a half, there are a dozen now vaccine candidates. One is this new novel technology around RNA. I've signed up to be a human subject with the RNA virus, the phase 3 trial.
What, through your own antibodies or just to be injected with a dead virus?
To be not dead virus. It's actually an RNA that actually instructs your T cells and B cells to produce antibody. And this is a really interesting technology.
Oh, okay.
And the science looks amazing. And I'm happy to be a human subject on it. So I've signed up through the CDC. They've not called on me yet. But because they know exactly what they're doing, what they're targeting, and they already have safety profile on phase 1 and phase 2, they can move right into phase 3. Now, that usually goes a year to 18 months. My bet is that if they see an exuberant response, they will start providing it to high-risk individuals and frontline workers late in 2020 or early in 2021. Mm. So when people say there'll be a vaccine, well, it won't be a widely distributed vaccine. You may be right. Maybe a year.
And that's basically the real start of traditional flu season, as it were, right?
And that kills 60,000 people a year. And you know, again, we got to keep that in mind, that flu kills too. And yet people don't even think about that. They don't even consider.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's I think the rule is that you can go to school, but if you know, if you get a fever the night before, you don't go to school. It's easy. But another interesting thing to talk about is health-wise and also mental health-wise. The world is changing, and it's changing so fast, about how this is going to affect us in the long term. I know, like with the 1919 outbreak, that it was a good year and a half, 2 years before, after things died down, before people felt comfortable enough to go about their daily business again, to get back into things they do in life.
Yes, yes. So that's there. I didn't answer the fourth part of your question, which was the second spike question.
Yeah,
I think what we're going to see is just we're going to be living with the virus at higher or lower pitches. In other words, right now we're in a bit of an uptick, and we're going to stay in that kind of higher daily. I don't think we're going to kick into the exponential growth phase. I think we're going to sort of stay in a pattern, and it may go down and it may go back up again. But I was talking to Dr. Charles Murray, who runs the University of Washington models at covid19.healthdata.org. It's a website I follow. I've kind of, again, it's models. It's just general ideas. It's not predicting the future. It just helps us kind of see where we're at, where we're going. And he said, you know, the best thing is if it doesn't go away during the summer, because then there will be a second peak. Yeah. Then there will be. So the fact that it's kind of trundled along means it's just going to be with us, and it could break out, but it's not technically going to be two outbreaks. It's just going to be with us. But back to 1918, not only did it take 3 to 5 years to recover, again, hard to tell because it was, of course, the backdrop of World War I. But one of the most famous psychiatrists in the country, a guy named Menninger, chronicled all the neuropsychiatric consequences of the virus. And there was neuropathies, there were psychoses, there were depressions, there were schizophreniform reactions, there was, you know, just general anxiety. I mean, the neuropsychiatric consequences were both directly viral related on the brain, a lot, very common. And you now start to hear people going, oh, my God, there are people complaining about things after they get well. Yes, that's what happens with a virus like this.
Uh-huh.
And as you mentioned, the ability to sort of regain our lives and feel comfortable again, it takes a while. Plus, the economic waves that are going to – I mean, it's going to take a while to recover from this thing. There are landmines everywhere, and we can't see them.
Right. That's the thing. We can't see them. And there's nobody who could really predict. We can make our best guess, and we can prepare as well as we can. Really, it's about preparing for the worst case scenario, is it not, in the end?
This is a really interesting question. That's a loaded question too, Dennis, because I do believe that certainly our public health officials have to have their eye on the worst case scenario. I believe that our decision makers should be paying careful attention to worst case scenario, but in every decision they make, realize if they strictly respond to worst cases, they're going to have all kinds of other unintended consequences. That maybe there's a way to navigate between worst case and being ignorant, you know, that you can, and that's what medicine's about. It's trying to make the right call, you know, and so they're being asked to make that kind of a decision.
You're talking about a moving target. I mean, they brought out what supposedly was the worst case scenario right at the beginning of this pandemic when they started having the meetings. They were saying 2 million people in the United States alone could die. The infection rate, which we weren't getting infection rates from China at all. The best we had was Italy and Europe. It caught everybody by surprise. And
I remember those moments, right? I remember being in that fog of war. And when Governor Newsom shut down California, I thought, oh, that is excessive. But I thought, well, he's looking at the worst case. It's a really tough decision. My responsibility is to back this leader in his decision making. And so I fully supported him. I understand it's tough. It's, you know, he really kind of had to prepare for worst case. And he's still in that mode. I've been critical since, because now you back off. Now, once you figure out what's going on, now's the time to be a little more nuanced in your decision making. And interestingly, somebody, a reporter, asked the LA County head of the LA County Department of Medicine yesterday, you know, if we have more hospitalized and more cases than back during the lockdown, why aren't you sounding the alarm this time? And she essentially said, well, we didn't really know what we were doing then. And I thought, well, that's right. Honest enough. That's true.
Yeah.
They had to figure things out, which is true.
I appreciate her honesty about that. Yeah, I can't figure out the numbers. I just can't. Reopening is, as far as we were talking about schools reopening and stuff, and that comes down to really as each state has its own decision-making process that goes along with that, do they not?
They not only each state, but each county and each school board. And I think, I don't know how you feel, but I always feel that the more centralized from on high, 3,000 miles away, the worst it is for the local community. The idea that this all should be federally mandated is insane to me. I don't even like the state mandating it. I think this should be county by county. Some counties have no cases, and some counties are in trouble.
I quite agree. Up here in Montana, they've had, I think, 3 cases in this county. You know, I think kids were, they didn't shut down for, or maybe they shut down for a week, but they were, I think they may have been going back to school, and they're planning on it here, I believe. It's local. Local is always the way to go, because all politics really are local too, by the way. People's needs when they live in a group in that particular locale, and one size doesn't fit all.
When Alexis de Tocqueville in 1822 came to the United States to essentially study the penitentiary system, but he ended up writing a book called Democracy in America, he was a Frenchman, an aristocrat, studying this new thing called democracy because he thought it was coming to France. Mm. And he said the reason it worked was that Americans practiced democracy local. It was the practice of democracy. It was the participation in local townships, in counties, in school boards. And it was the practice of being democratic locally that allowed it to be translated up to a more a state and then federal system.
Locally, it's anything big, it's never going to work out. Right. If you ask me, it's just tough.
Bottom line.
It's just really tough. You know, I hope we're having a different conversation next year. I would love to have you on the show next year and see where we are with that.
Please. I love that idea because it gives me hope. It gives me hope that in a year from now, we'll have a very different conversation, which will be great.
Hopefully we'll be doing it in person in a crowded room. It'll be great. Yeah, but I want to know, you sing opera, do you not?
I used to back in the old days.
Your mother was an opera singer.
My mother was an opera singer. You've done your homework. And for about 5 minutes, I thought I would maybe do that. And I thought better of it very wisely because I am a terrible musician. And I have a son who actually went to music conservatory who's an excellent musician.
I saw him playing piano. Yeah. He's excellent. Really good.
The distance between him and I is gigantic. So I'm glad I didn't make that effort. Well,
you seem to have those two strains of medicine and the arts.
It's weird how many doctors family. Do, at least back in the day. It was weird how many of them did. And then I recently did The Masked Singer, which was just fun. I thought, you know, when I saw that show, I thought they should put me on that. And the next day I was talking to the producers. But as a result of it, though, I found out I have a vocal cord problem. I have a varice in my cords, and I have the hemorrhage in my cords, and I have reflux. And so I knew that my singing had been, to say I lost a step would be an understatement.
Well, they need exercise too, you know, their muscles.
No, but my mid-range is just gone. It's gone.
Really? Well, I would love to hear you sing sometime.
Well, when we do the in-person in next year, maybe we'll think about that. We'll prepare for that. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. We'll sing God Bless America. It'll be
there
nice.
You go.
I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I really admire you through the years. Ed, I think you're doing great work out there, Dr. Drew, and keep it up. And
thanks, man. I always, until recently, like the last couple months, I was always deeply grateful for everything I got to do, because I didn't start out my career with any of this in mind. And to be able to do all these different and creative things and make a difference in a positive way, it was extremely gratifying. And I'm so grateful to have had these opportunities. Now, right now, I'm a little depressed because of all the situation we're in. But I feel reasonably confident that you've just given me that some of that confidence by talking about getting together next year. It's like somehow just that hope is enough to kind of help.
Well, every musician I know, they just took this year's tour schedule and just put it to next year. So I want it to happen so bad. Yeah. All right, my friend.
All right, man. Good to talk to you.
You have a good rest of the day, and God bless
you. Thanks, buddy. Yeah, you too.
If you want to hear more from Dr. Drew, you can go to drdrew.com, where you can find Dr. Drew After Dark and Dr. Drew TV for all his live streaming shows and podcasts.